Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. Now on view. More at NortonSimon.org.
You have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes, too, when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. We're listening to Sophia Loren perform the love theme from her 1958 film with Cary Grant, Houseboat. This week, our critics review the documentary, What Would Sophia Loren Do? Also on tap, several documentaries. They include MLK FBI, which uses newly declassified files to tell the story of the FBI's efforts to discredit and surveil Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Netflix's newest crime documentary series focuses on the chilling Night Stalker serial killings in 1980s L.A., and Anne Hathaway and Chiwetel Ejiofor star in the new comedy Lockdown, all coming your way on this week's Film Week.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at NortonSimon.org.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. I'm joined this week by critics Amy Nicholson, who's film writer for the New York Times and host of the podcasts Unspooled and Zoom. Peter Rayner, film critic for the Christian Science Monitor, and Claudia Puig, who's the president of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association and senior programmer for the AFI Film Festival. We begin with the documentary MLK FBI, appropriately enough, for this Dr. King holiday weekend. The documentary is directed by Sam Pollard. Amy?
Yeah, this documentary is a really necessary rewind. I mean, both for this weekend and for this year, to remind everybody how Martin Luther King Jr. was seen in his day at his time. You know, this is a documentary that takes you to the moment where he has this showdown with Hoover, the head of the FBI. Hoover calls him the biggest liar in America the week that he's getting his Nobel Peace Prize. Martin Luther King counters and points out that Hoover is not prosecuting violence against civil rights protesters. And in this showdown, America sides with the FBI. And so what Sam Pollard wants to do is really take us back to that moment to show us how the FBI had been seen on popular culture and why the FBI was going after Martin Luther King in the first place. You know, why they thought he, you know, brought along with him some fears about communism, why the number two of the FBI called him the most powerful person of color in America and said he must be destroyed. I mean, it's a very thorough and I think really wittily edited documentary. You know, it has a lot of footage from old movie clips, and it just feels like necessary history when it's easy to pretend that all of this didn't happen.
MLK, FBI, the documentary. Claudia.
Yeah, I agree completely with Amy. You know, we're reminded that, as she pointed out, that, you know, a lot of people, Americans, thought that J. Edgar Hoover was the good guy and Martin Luther King was the villain. And that has echoes of how many people feel about, say, Trump and the BLM movement today. So it couldn't be more timely. And it's a very detailed account of the FBI surveillance, the new tapes and files that have been released. You know, the idea of J. Edgar Hoover, we know how racist and paranoid he is. We've seen other accounts of that. But to see those two clashing, and also to see the sort of equanimity with which Dr. King deals with all of that. He just has this grace and this dignity, even when he's asked by a reporter, you know, don't you think Black people are asking for too much? And he just calmly responds. And I feel like it really shows the importance of King as a person, as a real human, as opposed to the icon that we have kind of come to think of him as. Yes, it shows, you know, the surveillance, and it perhaps shows him warts and all, but it shows that the humanity of him, and to me, the humanity is really what makes him a hero.
The documentary MLK FBI, Peter.
This is a very well put together movie that there isn't much in it that's new in terms of its documentation, but seeing it so graphically laid out like this really, you know, gives you the whole sordid history, you know, a cumulative intensity. The notion that the FBI was harassing and surveilling King because they felt he was a communist or had communist ties is sort of belied by the fact that so much of what the FBI was, you know, looking into was his sex life, his infidelities and so forth, alleged infidelities. And so also that the notion that this was some sort of rogue operation within the FBI is not true. That this was very much a part of the culture of the FBI at that time, which is a essentially all white bastion of G-men, you know, sort of conservative football playing frat types who were considered, you know, what saviors should look like in those days. And the director puts in some clips from films like I Was a Communist for the FBI and the FBI Story. To his credit, Pollard also brings up you know, some of the real controversies, specifically David Garrow, who won a Pulitzer for the King biography in 1986, who a number of years ago unearths, you know, some memos that will be not fully, you know, available till 2027 about, you know, King's supposedly was standing by during a rape of with a fellow minister and so forth. This has been hotly debated and countered by, for one, historian Jeannie Theo Harris, who said it was deeply irresponsible for a historian to cast such FBI sources, which can be deeply unreliable as fact. She wrote a Rosa Parks biography. But it does get into all of that, and I think, you know, it shows that there's, you know, a full comprehensive look at who this man was and his reckoning with racial injustice, which is so pertinent, you know, even today, of course.
MLK FBI, the documentary from filmmaker Sam Pollard. You can see it at the Cine Lounge Drive-In in Hollywood, and it's available on demand platforms, including Amazon Prime Video, Vudu, and Google Play. MLK FBI is unrated. The Romanian film Acasa, My Home, is a documentary that takes us to the wilderness of the Bucharest Delta. The film is directed by Radu Cernăciuc in a feature directorial debut. Claudia, what'd you think of Acasa, My Home?
I like this documentary a lot. I think Radu Cernăciuc, his background as an investigative journalist comes through loud and clear. His objective reporter's eye shows through. This has been a good year for Romanian documentaries. He had Collective and now this one. And by the way, this also won the World Cinema Documentary Special Jury Award for cinematography at Sundance. And the cinematography is stunning. It's a very empathetic portrait, but it also shows the complexities of this family who is living close to nature, and then they are uprooted by the government and put in government housing. It's shot over the course of 4 years. I think it's at its most poignant when it focuses on the children. It's a family with 9 children, and the father had been I think he worked in a lab. He had, you know, been a city dweller and eschewed all that and decided to raise his family. He raised the 9 kids out in this delta. And, you know, you see them picking up fish. Everything they're doing is done in a very rudimentary fashion. They live in a very rustic lifestyle. But he's also overbearing, and he's keeping them from being educated. So it's a complicated portrait. It's also a fascinating documentary about modernity and gentrification and freedom.
Acasa, My Home, Peter.
Yeah, this is a very interesting movie because for large sections of it, I felt you know, even though it's clearly a documentary, the access that the director had to this family over these 4 years is so you know, intimate that you wonder how they would ever have allowed cameras in, you know, to the hut where the family lives, to the fights, to the all, you know, the running away from child services. All of these things seem, you know, very much out of a dramatic feature, and yet it is a documentary. I hope you don't find out, you know, in a year that this is all staged or something, because it certainly is a remarkable piece of documentary access. It's also very conflicting for me because, you know, on the one hand, this, you know, getting away from civilization and living with nature is a kind of, you know, agrarian dream. But so much of what the children, is, you know, as Claudia pointed out, have to endure, you know, the illiteracy and all of the poverty of living where they are, and, you know, before they move to Budapest is really difficult, I think, to watch, because so clearly they're being compromised in so many ways by this father who clearly loves them, but at the same time is just so autocratic that he's, you know, wrecking their lives without their full knowledge. The most touching moment, I think, was, you know, after they've been living in the city, and one of the littlest kids of the nine wants to go back to the wildlife, and he says, where even the food tasted better.
The movie is Casa, My Home, from Bucharest, the documentary directed by Radu Chornichuk. The film is available on Lemle's Virtual Cinema, and it's unrated. Our third straight documentary film to open the week is very close to home, Night Stalker, The Hunt for a Serial Killer, which takes us back to the 1980s when a mass murderer rapist was making his way throughout the greater Los Angeles area. Tiller Russell, the director. Claudia?
Well, I remember this very vividly, having lived through it. You know, I remember the terror of that summer, locking my windows. I remember hearing on the news there was a run on guns. You know, the average person was you know, looking for ways to protect themselves. And there really was a sense of terror. Larry, you probably remember it too.
I remember because one of his crimes that he committed was a couple blocks from where I lived. So, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Hit very close
wow.
to home.
Wow. Yeah, it was terrifying. And, you know, some of that is picked up here. But I unfortunately, I think this was kind of slick and sensationalistic. It feels a lot like Netflix's other crime doc, you know, series, which, you know, are somewhat sensationalistic. I won't say that it wasn't involving, and there were some scenes that were quite gripping, particularly a victim of his who is still alive, who was taken as a 6-year-old, kidnapped and molested and then set free, where he basically told her, you know, I'm going to drop you at this gas station and call your parents. And then, of course, you see all the other horrific stuff. It tries to capture and recreate this climate of fear, but it really focuses more on the thrills and chills. It does kind of anchor it by looking at the two police officers or sheriff's deputies, I guess they were, who were at the heart of it, who were, you know, kind of a Hollywood construction almost, it seems. Frank Salerno, who is this taciturn, grizzled veteran, and Gil Carrillo, who was from East LA and was a rookie. And they have some great observations. Some of the more interesting observations are their kind of personal reflections on the toll, the emotional toll it took for them to work on the case. In some ways, it feels padded. I really was sort of put off by the sensationalistic aspect of it, but you know, I was caught up in it.
And this is a multi-part series, Claudia?
Yes, it's a 4-part series.
4 parts. Night Stalker, The Hunt for a Serial Killer. Amy?
Yeah, I also was off-put by the salaciousness of it. You know, it's a film that uses the unsolved mysteries style of, like, reenactments, but then also, like, real crime scene photos. So you're veering back and forth between, you know, melodrama and drops of blood in slow motion, but also actual harm that was done to real people. And then on top of that, you get these quotes from the Night Stalker himself are, like, scrawled across the screen in hot pink. You know, and they, towards the end, I mean, by the 4th episode, they're even using, like, Pac-Man in, like, imagery to try to remind us that this is all taking place in the 80s. It does not congeal to me at all. And, you know, I was interested in some of the methodology, but I think the interviews that they got out of Detective Frank Salerno and Gil Carrillo, they have kind of this backslapping quality that I also found really uncomfortable. You know, it's interesting when Gil is talking about how hard it was for people to believe his instinct that these are all done by the same person, to take us back to that moment where you didn't know if this was a serial killer or several different killers, and him kind of coming forth as like this young guy, ambitious, trying to be heard and people not listening to him. That is interesting, but something in the way that it's framed, it just makes it feel like they're kind of, I mean, I think they are literally shooting some of their scenes in the bar, in a bar, which is why it feels like they're just guys telling stories after work. It felt a little bit disrespectful.
Night Stalker, The Hunt for a Serial Killer, 4-part docuseries on Netflix. It's unrated. Tiller Russell, the director. Also, we just want to remind you the film One Night in Miami is still available on Amazon Prime Video. It recreates and fictionalizes what was an actual night in which Muhammad Ali, Malcolm X, Sam Cooke, and Jim Brown came together. Regina King makes her feature directorial debut, One Night in Miami. And later this hour, our John Horn will interview the actor who played Jim Brown, the only surviving member of that quartet of famous Americans who spent that evening together. Let's quickly hear, Peter, what you thought of One Night in Miami.
Yeah, it's a compelling, well-made movie, based on a play, uniformly well-acted. This is the second movie, along with Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, where it features a essentially all-black cast, all doing first-rate work. And also, I'd like to single out Beau Bridges, who has a lacerating cameo playing opposite the Jim Brown character, played by Aldous Hodge, which is really quite powerful in the beginning.
One Night in Miami. Amy, quick thought on it.
Agree. I mean, when you're staging something that's like mostly men talking to each other in a small hotel room, you have to have these like vital actors, their personalities have to keep it motoring. And I mean, during it, I kept toggling back and forth, like which one is my favorite, which one is my favorite, because the performances are all really strong. I'm a particular big fan of Eli Gorey, who plays Muhammad Ali.
What do you think, Claudia?
Masterful. And it never felt static, even though it was in that hotel room, because of the superb dialogue and the masterful acting by all four.
Again, it's One Night in Miami. Regina King, the director. It's rated R. It begins streaming today on Amazon Prime Video. And Aldous Hodge, who plays Jim Brown, will be the subject of interview coming up later this hour with our John Horn. It's Film Week on KPCC.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
You're listening to Film Week on KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Just want to remind you, if you don't get a chance to hear Film Week when it airs on KPCC, you can listen to it anytime you want. In fact, it's one of the most popular podcasts. You can hear it wherever you get your podcasts. Film Week, available to go at your convenience. We're so glad to have you with us, Larry Mantle, joined by critics Claudia Puig, Amy Nicholson, and Peter Rayner. Last year, Sophia Loren, 86 years old, starred in a film directed by her son titled The Life Ahead, a film that I really enjoyed. It's still available to see on Netflix. This week brings a documentary short, What Would Sophia Loren Do?, directed by Ross Kaufman. Peter, tell us a little bit about this short.
Yeah, well, this is a film about Nancy Vincenza Kulik, a very talkative and voluble senior citizen, grandmother who lives in Fort Lee, New Jersey. And Ross Kaufman, the director, who I believe was a co-director of Born Into Brothels, which was an Academy Award-winning documentary. So he was captivated by this woman who has, an extraordinary life of sort of hero-worshipping Sophia Loren in a way that not just sort of, you know, the usual starstruck stuff, but she really sort of took Loren as a role model for how she should live her life from as a young girl watching her movies growing up, and eventually, spoiler alert, you know, they do get together at the very end of this documentary to meet, which is wonderful to see. But Vincenza is an amazing woman because she, you know, I mean, it sounds corny, but, you know, she really does ask herself, what would Sophia Loren do? Like, you know, even when it comes to something like, you know, would she eat whole wheat pasta?
The answer is no. I would guess no. Yes.
You know, she doesn't do that. So it's that sort of thing. There are a lot of clips of both Vincenza as a young girl and also many clips, wonderful clips of Sophia Loren's movies, you know, Gold of Naples and the comedies, but also Two Women, which was a really harrowing, great film by De Sica with a rape scene in it. That's one of the most powerful, I think, ever put on film. And we see that, and we also see that, you know, when Vincenza's 51-year-old son died suddenly in 2016, she took great heart in Sophia Loren's never give up attitude and so forth. So it's an interesting concept that is pulled off because the women are so interesting in it, and I also think it brings up this whole notion that we all have on some level of, you know, how do we relate to movie stars, and in what sense do we actually try to model our behavior on them. It's a fascinating conundrum.
The documentary short, What Would Sophia Loren Do?, from director Ross Kaufman, is unrated, and it's streaming on Netflix. The crime comedy Locked Down stars Anne Hathaway, Chiwetel Ejiofor, and Stephen Merchant. Doug Liman, the director, Stephen Knight, wrote the screenplay. Amy, what'd you think of Locked Down?
This is an interesting stunt that is, I think, very much of the age of COVID. I mean, Doug Liman is a director who's known for making big action spectacles, you know, Born Identity and Edge of Tomorrow and Mr. and Mrs. Smith. And it's, you know, early on in COVID, I think he got that itch where he was like, I have to make a movie even though we're indoors. And he got Chiwetel Ejiofor and Anne Hathaway on board. And the story here that they try to figure out is that it's about a couple who break up very early on during the pandemic in London. It seems to be about April. And it's like just about their adjustment to COVID at first, you know, kind of noting all the little things that we all know now very well, you know, like, oh, you can wear your pajama pants under your blouse and full makeup while you're doing a Zoom call. Oh, you should hoard toilet paper and make bread. So in that sense, you're watching something that already feels kind of quaint and bizarre, you know, a film that being shot in July, but then set several months ago. And now here we are in January. And of course, that's not enough to really make a story. And so where they go from there is that, like, these two people, even though they're breaking up, they're realizing how badly, you know, the working world has let them down. In essence, they're having this moment of pause. And they decide to combine their jobs and come up with a heist that could make them some money. And the heist basically makes very little sense and had me screaming at the screen. I was like, what are you doing? I don't like any of this. This is insane. It's a film that I think is really in a tough place because you want to roll your eyes at everything it's saying about where we are living right now because it feels outdated, even though it's just coming out. But I wonder how I will feel watching this film in 10 years as it reminds me that we are all adjusting badly in April.
Locked Down, the crime comedy. What did you think, Claudia?
Yeah, not only does it feel undated, I think it also feels sort of tone deaf. I mean, London right now, 1 in 30 people have COVID. It's a mess. It's, you know, almost as bad or you know, maybe on the same level as Los Angeles right now. So a heist film about well-off people in a very well-appointed flat stealing a diamond during the pandemic feels pretty tone deaf, especially in light of, you know, the sacrifices made by essential workers and people who have suffered, who've gotten sick or lost jobs. It just feels cringy in that respect. And I'm actually really surprised because the screenwriter, Stephen Knight, is someone that I really admire. He did this amazing film called Block with Tom Hardy a few years ago that took place entirely in a car over the, you know, in real time. He was sitting in a car seat, navigating the worst day of his life on these phone calls. And that was brilliantly done. And it felt like it could have been a play. This definitely feels like a play in the worst kind of way. It feels stagey and claustrophobic and overacted. There feels like there's no real empathy for the real cause underlying quarantine. And I realize this doesn't have to be deep. It's trying to be light, but at the same time, there's this kind of cloying annoyance on the part of the two, Chiwetel and Anne Hathaway, who are wonderful actors, and they do their best, and maybe even excessively, you know, more than their best. But their outrage and existential angst just feels cringeworthy. And overall, it just didn't. Oh, the heist also was really stupid. Sorry.
No,
it was one of the worst heists I've ever seen. It made no sense.
Lockdown is the film starring Anne Hathaway and Chiwetel Ejiofor. Doug Liman directs. It's rated R and it's on HBO Max. The documentary Some Kind of Heaven gives us a look at the villages in Florida, America's largest retirement community. Lance Oppenheim is the director. Claudia?
Yeah, I have to say I didn't know anything about this place, the villages. It's in Central Florida. It has 100,000 residents. I think they said 20,000 of them are single. So there's kind of this whole, kind of dating thing going on too with among the seniors. We follow them as they look for human connection or try to deal with the connections that they have. It's an observational documentary. I wish someone like Errol Morris had done it because I think it would have been more capably done. I think sometimes it's poignant, other times it's chilling, sometimes it's just depressing. But it doesn't tell you anything about the structure of the villages. I kept wondering, how does this work? Because apparently they have churches and they have restaurants. It's like this whole community. How much does it cost to go there? We figure these people are pretty well off. There's one guy who lives in a van who's pretending to be a part of it, wants to meet a rich woman. I had some issues with some of the tone, and I felt like this oppressive, suffocating cheeriness of the place was, that's part of the point, but I just really wanted to know more about how it's run, the more details than were explored here.
I seem to recall that in the villages a few months ago, they had some pretty intense clashes between Trump supporters and Biden supporters with golf cart parades and the like. Seems to me that made the national news. We're talking about the villages in Florida, which are profiled in the documentary Some Kind of Heaven. Amy.
Wow, I'd love to see Lance get a chance to re-edit this documentary and add that in. I mean, this is an incredibly active community. I mean, so people are picturing how active this is. This is a community that has synchronized swimming and cheerleading and rowing and belly dancing. There's drum lines, there's bowling, there's like karaoke and night clubbing. Like, this is a very active community. And the people that we're looking at here, you've got kind of a woman who is a bit cynical about everything. She thinks that this is just another place where kind of girls get stratified into like popular and not, that you have to act cheerful all the time in order to get along. And so dating is not going well for her there. You have a couple that's been together for 47 years. And in this community, now that they have nothing but time on their hands, the man is just regressing. He gets arrested for drugs, and she's just trying to do tennis with her friends. And then, you have this guy who's like a predator, living out of his van and trying to pick up rich women and not being at all shy about it. And then underneath that, you have this interesting stuff about how the town was put together, that they made up a fictional story for this community so that it would look like an old town. They painted cracks into the walls and the bricks. They tried to make it look like it had a Spanish history that then evolved throughout the ages. All of that psychological stuff, I think, is really interesting. But the point that I really walked away with was this documentary, maybe it's just the subjects they're picking, but that every man in this community just seems to act like a crazy teenager. They've all just regressed from the way they put the story together. And that seems incredibly terrifying.
Some Kind of Heaven, the documentary, Peter?
Well, yeah, I don't know. I think everybody in this movie is pretty regressed. I don't know. I think this is one of these documentaries that has a great subject and doesn't quite know where to deal with it. They focus on these four couples, and they're all somewhat interesting to observe, but you don't really get the sense of the larger picture here. I was wondering, why are we sticking with these, rather eccentric stories as opposed to, this is the largest retirement community in America. There's over 100,000 people. What does it cost? How does it operate? What do these people read? What are their politics? that's true about that clip with the white power guy in the golf cart that was in the Trump rally a while back. You know, I mean, what exactly, how does this place operate? And instead of getting a sense of that, I guess I'm, you know, asking for more of a Fred Wiseman kind of movie. We just sort of focus on these four eccentric couples and don't really get much of a sense of the larger picture.
The documentary is Some Kind of Heaven, which profiles the villages in Florida. Lance Oppenheim, the director. It's unrated. It's on Lemley's Virtual Cinema. You can also see it at home on the on-demand platforms of Google Play, Fandango, and Amazon Prime Video. The Swiss drama My Little Sister stars Nina Hoss. The film's written and directed by Stephanie Chouat and Véronique Raymond. The film's unrated. Claudia, what'd you think of My Little Sister?
I really like this film. It's kind of quiet. It was superbly acted by Nina Hoss and Lars Eidinger as fraternal twins. It's emotionally powerful. It's not fussy. It's about his slowly dying of leukemia. So it could easily have become a conventional tearjerker or something manipulative. It doesn't go in that direction, fortunately. It doesn't go in really directions that the audience would expect. And we don't find very many stories of adult siblings. Or if we do, they tend to be, you know, about brotherly love or sisterly something. And you know, with the exception of maybe You Can Count on Me and The Savages, maybe you have to have Laura Linney in them if you're American. But this one was really, really very well done. It's low key. It's modestly scaled. It's naturalistic. It's a story about she lives in Switzerland. They both are from Berlin. She's a gifted playwright, Nina's character from Berlin, and then she goes with her husband to this kind of idyllic little Swiss town where he is a headmaster at this upper crust boarding school, and her brother is this very celebrated gay stage actor. So she had written roles for him before, and she wants to write some more roles for him to kind of bring him in his final days. And he's kind of the dominant figure in their bond, but they're like soulmates. And it's really interesting to watch their interaction. They're both such wonderful actors. It's well written, and she just brings this vulnerability and desperation kind of to her character. I thought it was really pretty great.
My Little Sister is unrated, and it's on Lemley's Virtual Cinema. Boy, you mentioned a couple of gems, in my view, the You Can Count on Me and The Savages, those films starring Laura Linney. The Marksman, a thriller that stars Liam Neeson and Catherine Winnick, with Teresa Ruiz as well. Robert Lorenz, the director, Chris Charles, Danny Kravitz, and Robert Lorenz are the screenwriters. Amy, we've got just about 1 minute for your review of The Marksman.
Sure, that's about all it needs. This film was really disappointing, you know, in two ways. I mean, A, the story itself is just disappointing. It feels like a Clint Eastwood reject. But B, this is a movie where you're realizing that I think Liam Neeson has now this actor who I've always thought has so much integrity is just becoming a paycheck player, doing a movie, getting a check, going home, and he's starting to lose that sheen of person whose movies I must always watch because he's going to be great. The setup here is that he's a guy who lives on the Arizona border, and he's, you know, a kind of all-American, humbled protagonist who's going to make good. You know, he's a widower. He's a Vietnam vet. He's losing his farm. He's an alcoholic. And he would probably call himself like an apolitical guy, but he thinks big government is dumb. Anyways, he sees a mom and a son run across the border. They're chased by the cartel. He saves the kid. You know the rest. There's nothing interesting here. He's very bad at this.
The Marksman, directed by Robert Lorenz, rated PG-13 at the Vineland Drive-In in Industry, Montclair's Mission Tiki Drive-In, and in Riverside, the Van Buren Drive-In. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC, the KPCC app, and podcasts everywhere. So good to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up a little bit later this hour, our John Horn is in conversation with actor Aldous Hodge, who plays Jim Brown, the NFL football great, and the only surviving member of the gathering portrayed in One Night in Miami with Muhammad Ali, Malcolm X, Sam Cooke, and Jim Brown. It's Aldous Hodge, star of One Night in Miami with John Horn later on Film Week. We're joined this week by critics Peter Rayner, Claudia Puig, and Amy Nicholson. Next up is Love, Sarah, a romantic comedy from the UK and Europe. Eliza Schroeder is the director. Jake Brunger is the screenwriter of the film, which stars Celia Imrie and Shannon Tarbett. Claudia, what'd you think of Love, Sarah?
Well, this is a very slight movie. It's likable and it's warm-hearted. It's about three women spanning several generations who open a bakery. They're all connected by their love for Sarah, who tragically died on her bicycle on the way to opening this bakery. So it's you know, none of it seems all that plausible. But if you're a fan of, say, the Great British Baking Show, or you just like to look at beautiful confections, there are plenty here. And they decide to do these favorite desserts of immigrants living in London, sort of with a nod to the multiculturalism of London. So they're making, you know, desserts from Greece and Iran and Latvia and Venezuela and Japan. And so that's fun to watch. And in fact, I think the titular Sarah, who I'm not sure we ever see, or maybe we see her in a flashback. She was actually on the Great British Baking Show in 2010. So.
I was going to say, and who doesn't love the sort of supportive way the contestants on that show relate to each other?
It's such
a nice antidote to what we see in this country.
Absolutely. I've been tuning into it a lot lately. Yeah, after after reading the news, I just want some British.
So civilized. Love,
yes.
Sarah. This, though, a fictional romantic comedy. Peter, what'd you think?
Well, it's. I think it works as a piece of pastry porn. You see a lot of really scrumptious pastries being made and consumed. It's sort of like a B-side, flip side of the kind of Richard Curtis movies that, 4 Weeks and a Funeral, Love Actually, Notting Hill, those films. It's kind of a weaker T version of that kind of movie. Celia Imrie is always worth watching. Weirdly, she plays in the movie a retired trapeze artist. I'm not quite sure how they came up with that one. It's also nice to see Bill Patterson, who's in the film, who plays a security specialist who lives across the street from the pastry shop. He's a wonderful Scottish actor. You may recall from some Bill Forsyth films like Comfort and Joy. Always nice to see these faces, but it's pretty benign.
Love, Sarah is unrated. It's available on iTunes, Fandango Now, and Vudu. Chusenjo, the main battleground of the Comfort Women issue, a documentary from director Miki Dazaki. Peter?
It's a fascinating movie. Dazaki is a second-generation Japanese-American who's immigrant parents. He found out about the Comfort woman story from them, and when he was teaching in Japan in English, he got harassed by a lot of right-wing nationalists there over the whole issue of, were Korean women especially used as sex slaves during the Japanese occupation in World War II. The Japanese, for the most part, officially have maintained that they were not sex slaves, they were prostitutes. And so this has created a tremendous international rift that's gone on for many years. And the film deals with that. The director talks to a lot of historians and a lot of the people who support the nationalism of the denial, really, of the fact that there were these sex slaves. Some fascinating interviews, including the sort of the head of the Japanese nationalists, who's also apparently a distant cousin of Yoko Ono. But the whole history of sex slavery has been deleted from school textbooks. Shinzo Abe, who's the prime minister there, has really, denied much of this. They also highlight some of the controversy, a while back in Glendale, where there was a lot of controversy about the erecting of statues to the Comfort women in Glendale and also in San Francisco.
The documentary Shusenjo, The Main Battleground of the Comfort Women Issue from director Miki Dezaki. It's available on Apple TV and Amazon Prime Video starting next Tuesday, and the documentary is unrated. The sci-fi action film Outside the Wire stars Anthony Mackie and Damson Idris. The film is directed by Mikael Hofstrom and the screenplay co-written by Rowan and Rob Yescom. Amy.
Yeah, this is a near future war movie for people who just want to zone out and watch some bang, bang, bangs and be like, okay, explosions. The story here is that we're in 2036. There's a civil war in Eastern Europe and that the U.S. is involved. It seems like it's mainly taking place in the Ukraine, but that the U.S. is fighting mostly with guys on drones in Nevada. And so it opens with this like chaotic screaming battle, but it keeps cutting back to people in Nevada in this little room eating chips and, you know, watching drones. And then one of the people, this character named Harper, who's played by Damson Idris, he's already killed like 163 people in drone warfare, and he's finally sent to the front to learn the lesson, you know, to learn about the weight of death. And so really where this story kicks off is that he gets taken in by Anthony Mackie, who's like this biotech classified prototype soldier. He's got this translucent six-pack. And they go off on this mission to get these Cold War nuclear bombs before Russians do, before this like evil terrorist guy does. But really, this film wants to be very smart. You know, the what it's getting at is like the questions of who are the bad guys? Isn't everybody a bad guy in war? What about ethics and humanity in war? And it wants to go there and like have this kind of wrestling conflict with like what is good, what is bad, you know. Is the loss of life ever acceptable? But really all that kind of sticks out is it's just like, oh, here goes one building exploding. Here's some more people dying. And it doesn't actually feel like it gets into it. It's just a lot of death and destruction. And the lead actor, I want to like him, but he's kind of a drone himself. So there's not really a compelling character there.
Outside the Wire is rated R. It's streaming on Netflix. I want to take a moment to remember director Michael Apted, who died here in Los Angeles just last week. Known for a number of his films like Coal Miner's Daughter, starring Sissy Spacek, Gorillas in the Mist, The World is Not Enough, the James Bond film, and many others. But to me, he's most memorable for his Up series of documentaries, which every 7 years followed a group of what were first British school kids all the way through to into their 60s. Peter, your thoughts about the importance of Apted's work?
Yeah, I mean, he was, you know, the kind of director who could do just about anything, you know, reminiscent of the old studio days. You mentioned those films. Also, Agatha was a wonderful film. And he did documentaries aside from the Up series. He did a Sting documentary, Bring on the Night, and a terrific documentary about Tiananmen Square, Moving the Mountain. But the Up series is such an extraordinary conception and such an extraordinary piece of work. That it's really, you know, unique, and there are very few films that are like that in the history of film that just have that kind of, you know, resonance and power and uniqueness to them. And one of the many reasons I felt sad hearing about Apted was because I realized, I guess, this is the end of that series, and that, you know, the lives that we saw in that film are sort of frozen in time now. You know, without any continuation. But it was an extraordinary achievement and, you know, really something that I think should be cherished.
Claudia, quick thought on Michael Apted passing at the age of 79.
Yes, he was, the Up series is so amazing, and it obviously inspired a lot of other filmmakers. I think of someone like Richard Linklater and Boyhood, you know, how much it influenced that. The other films that he made, the narrative films, were also really impressive. It's a great loss.
Amy, thought on Michael Apted?
Well, I just have to say that once I was in London and I got into a cab and it was randomly Tony, who is one of the characters, Tony Walker, the cab driver in the Up series. And it was like one of the highlights of my life.
I bet I would have been as excited as you, having followed all those films over the years. That's great. All right. Thanks so much, our film critics this week. By the way, Amy Nicholson, Claudia Puig, and Peter Rayner. Coming up next, KPCC's John Horn in conversation with one of the stars of One Night in Miami. That's all to come. Aldous Hodge with John Horn coming up right here on Film Week on KPCC.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
I'm Julia Paskin, host of Weekend Edition. Join me as I talk with NPR's Sarah McCammon about her new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. She's not alone in leaving the church. She's found she's among a rising generation fleeing the fold. That's April 25th at the Crawford in Pasadena. Tickets at laist.com/events.
It's Film Week on KPCC. I'm Larry Manchel. As we mentioned earlier this hour, One Night in Miami is now streaming on Amazon Prime Video. It's the fictional telling of a gathering between Muhammad Ali, Malcolm X, Sam Cooke, and NFL great Jim Brown. Aldous Hodge portrays Brown and joins our John Horn.
I want to ask you about an early acting gig you had. It was on Broadway in the musical Showboat. And I believe Samuel L. Jackson recommended to your mom that when you were filming Die Hard with a Vengeance, that you do something on stage. I don't think you were 10 yet. So how important was Showboat? And I looked it up. The cast then included Elaine Stritch, John McMartin, Rebecca Luker. Great cast. What did that mean to you in terms of your acting education?
We were shooting Die Hard with a Vengeance. I was playing Sam's nephew in the film. And my mom was asking about, you know, just tips and acting things, you know, how we can move forward as young actors, right? So, you know, thank you to Sam. He gave us the game. He told my mom, if you boys want to learn, you know, real acting, get them on stage. So coincidentally enough, after finishing the film, we go to an audition where my brother gets the job and we get to see the contract just for 6 months. My mom was like, she thought it was a commercial. She was like, what kind of commercial takes 6 months to shoot? But then we realized it was Broadway, you know? So my brother had the job first. And then about a year into it, because we did about, there was a 2.5 year tour on Broadway. About a year into it, one of the other kids aged out and I was old enough. At this point, I think I was 9 years old. I was old enough to join the cast. So my brother and I both did Showboat on Broadway for that next year and a half. And, you know, it's fantastic because it does set up your instincts and your foundation for who you are as a performer, how you're going to attack your craft, how to connect with the audience because they're there every single night. And if you mess up, you make a mistake, they see it, they feel it. There's no camera to hide behind, take one, take two, you know. There were many times we had to start thinking on our feet. And improv is a fantastic vehicle for understanding stage because I remember there would be times where run out on stage, you forget something, but you still got to play it off like I forgot a prop or a tool or whatever. And, you know, the kid inside me wants to cry, but I'm on stage and I can't. Well, one time when I was running up a ramp and there's an actress who's supposed to be chasing me running behind me, I tripped and fell. I'm like all of 9 years old, 2 pounds wet, soaking wet, like you nothing, right? She tripped, she fell on top of me, covered me clearly. I disappeared. My mama's in the audience like, what is happening with my baby? Like, where's he at? Anyway, you play that off. You know what I mean? You get up, you run back again. And it was great fun. It was me and my brother handling business, two kids with this magnificent show. You have an entire stage just moving and changing. So your imagination is like exploding, but you also understand the true essence of performance.
I want to read you something you said a couple of years ago about how you decide what you want to do and why those things are important. Here's what you said. The impact of what we do is, to a degree, our responsibility. You always want to have a positive impact. What you do on screen helps to influence how people see things in their daily lives, and it could alter their perception to thinking, what I rejected before because I didn't understand it has now become something that I do understand. Given what you said there, and I love what you said, how does a movie like One Night in Miami factor into that thinking about impact and understanding and changing the way people might see the world?
as someone who's ambitious in this business about trying to really lay out a fantastic career, opportunities that I wanted were not always there. So there was a time in my career I had to tell my agents and manager that I'm not going out for the thug, the this, the that, the athlete, you know, because that's all that was there. I wanted to go out for other areas of creative outlets that were true to me. But, you know, it wasn't common to see the Black doctor, the Black da da da. But, and that's another thing that, you know, is detrimental, is that every time growing up again, I saw that we were in a space where we are a lawyer, a doctor. It always was the Black guy, the Black this, that. Why is my color so important to you? It's exhausting having to explain that and having to be validated in a particular position by my color. He's a doctor, but he's Black. But it's frustrating. All that to be said, I like to take on projects that speak towards that progression that I feel have the weight and the power. And when it comes to One Night in Miami, the thing that I love about this is it speaks so currently to the time. It speaks so currently to what we've all been going through, how I was raised, what we have been fighting for forever and fighting through forever. I think it exposes people to a private conversation where we as men, who people think are these grand patriarchs, these legends, and they are, they absolutely are, but they're still Black men in America, and they're still dealing with the things that Black culture deals with in America. They're not absolved. We get to learn how they have debates and differences, and we get to see how they can have that conversation, how they can positively and progressively get through differences and find sort of a commonality, common ground, if you will, which I love because it's so representative of the example that needs to be set for our culture and community now and other cultures who are curious about what we're going through in terms of how to have the conversation.
I want to ask you about being on set of this film on One Night in Miami. The story is set in 1964, and it's during segregation, and the story unfolds in what we'll call a Green Book Hotel because it's the only place Blacks could stay, the Hampton House in Miami. And on set, in when you're filming this, you have four Black actors, you have a Black female director, Regina King, Kemp Powers, your playwright and screenwriter is a Black man, your composer is Terrence Blanchard, a Black man. It's unimaginable to think in that period where this story is set that anything like that could happen. Were you ever aware of how much change has come just on the set of this film and who was making it and the fact that they had a chance to tell this story?
No. I'll tell you why. Oftentimes we presume change has come, but when we're in the current times and still having the conversations we're having, when people, Black people can still get lynched and there's no repercussions, when Black people can still die at the hands of police officers without any real justice happening, when justice is often contested as vehemently as it has been, there is no real change that's happened. Change is happening, but lest we get comfortable enough to understand that we still have work to do, change will never actually remain. For us to all be in that room, we're doing a job. We're doing our service for ourselves and for our next generation. We're still dealing with being defined by the color of our skin. As I said previously, it's exhausting. So when I see years of consistency, 20, 30, 40 years, where we're dealing with a new problem, yeah, that's when I will acknowledge that change has happened. But right now, things have an opportunity to change. Change isn't here, but it's happening. And I have the hope that we have the power to drive it to keep happening until it stays here.
KPCC's John Horn talking with one of the stars of the new film One Night in Miami, Aldis Hodge. The film is now streaming on Amazon Prime Video. That's it for Film Week here on KPCC. Thank you so much for joining us and have a terrific MLK weekend.
Hey. It's Brian, the host of the How to LA podcast. How about we go to the movies? Join us for a 10-part series, Revival House, and discover the magic of LA's indie theaters. Who knows? You might meet someone.
I know it sounds antithetical because you're just sitting passively, but in fact, you're connecting with everyone else around you.
Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios wherever you listen to podcasts.